Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive where we, we take a deep dive into some fascinating legal issues. Today, we're going to be tackling a case out of the Indiana Supreme Court, Williams v. State. And it really gets to the heart of a question that we see a lot in sexual assault law, which is, can a victim's past be used against them in court?
Yeah, and this case is really a fascinating look into this whole idea of the rape shield rule. And it's really kind of a balancing act, right? How do you make sure that you're protecting victims, but also ensuring that the person who's accused is getting a fair trial?
It's a tough one, right?
Yeah, really tough.
Yeah, and this case gets even, I think, more interesting because it specifically looks at when a victim's past sexual history or even their drug use can be considered admissible in a trial.
Right. And I think what's so compelling about this case is that it forces us to kind of confront some of the uncomfortable biases that we have in society and how those biases can actually seep into the courtroom. And I think, it's a reminder that the legal system isn't immune to these biases, so we have to be very careful to safeguard against them.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's set the scene here. We're in Indianapolis, 1997. We have a topless dancer. She finishes her shift, and she asks two strangers for a ride home.
Adrian Williams and Antoine Edmondson.
Adrian Williams and Antoine Edmondson, that's right. But instead of taking her home, they drive her to, well, kind of a secluded alley.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, and she tries to escape, but Edmondson pulls her back into the car and they end up in a parking lot. And that's where things, according to the victim, kind of take a turn for the worse. Both men, allegedly at gunpoint, order her to perform sexual acts.
It's a terrifying situation, and it actually takes an even more dramatic turn because the victim ends up grabbing the gun, she breaks free from them, and she actually shoots Edmondson as she's escaping.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's already a crazy story. But then here's where the legal battle lines really start to get drawn, because Williams and Edmondson claim that no, she agreed to have sex with them in exchange for drugs, they said.
Yeah, so it's really a he said, she said situation. Two completely different stories of what happened that night.
Two totally contrasting narratives.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the defense try to kind of support their claims in this situation?
Well, they tried to use her past against her. They wanted to introduce evidence of the fact that she had engaged in prostitution before, and they were trying to imply that this somehow made her more likely to consent in this instance with Williams and Edmondson.
So they were basically saying that because she may have, engaged in sex work in the past, she's automatically more likely to consent in any situation.
Yeah, that's basically what they were getting at.
It just sounds, that's problematic to say the least.
Oh, it's hugely problematic. It really highlights the dangers of relying on stereotypes,
Yeah.
They were essentially trying to fit her into this narrative that served their interests, but completely disregarding, her autonomy and the specifics of the case.
Totally. But, wasn't there some sort of legal safeguard to prevent this kind of attack on her character? I feel like there should be.
Absolutely. That's where Indiana's rape shield law comes into play.
Okay.
It's also called Evidence Rule 412. It's designed to prevent evidence of a victim's past sexual conduct being used in a sex crime case. And it's really there to, try to shield victims from being harassed and from these attacks that are really trying to prejudice the jury.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So how did the defense in this case try to get around that?
Well, they try to argue that her past was relevant to proving consent and just challenging her credibility overall. But the court, they weren't buying it. And the big point here is that the alleged prostitution involved other men, not Williams and Edmondson, the defendants in this case.
So the court was recognizing that a woman's past sexual experiences with other people, that doesn't have any bearing on whether she consented to sexual activity with these two men, Williams and Edmondson.
Exactly. The court shut that whole argument down hard. And I think one of the justices, Justice Baum, he wrote this really powerful line in the opinion. He said, "It is intolerable to suggest that because the victim is a prostitute, she automatically is assumed to have consented with anyone at any time." It's a very strong statement.
Yeah, that's very powerful. It really speaks to a woman's right to bodily autonomy, regardless of what her past may be. But what about the defense's argument about her drug use and how that could have affected her memory? Could that be a legitimate concern in this case?
It's understandable to consider that drug use could affect memory. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
But the court, they addressed this head on.
Okay.
And they pointed out that there was no evidence to suggest that her past drug use actually impaired her ability to perceive and remember what happened or to testify accurately.
So they were basically saying, we need concrete evidence not just, you know, speculation, to conclude that her past drug use actually affected her testimony.
Exactly. Exactly. They were not willing to accept just like conjecture or assumptions. They wanted to see proof. And they also made another really important observation, which is that her credibility had already been challenged during cross-examination.
Right. So the defense had already had their chance to kind of poke holes in her story. And the court was basically saying, there's no need to bring up this drug use thing again.
Yeah, they saw it as an unnecessary attempt to just further discredit her and, you know, potentially prejudice the jury. They were saying, look, allowing this evidence wouldn't add any real value to the case, especially since you've already had a chance to cross-examine her.
Yeah, that makes sense. So far we've established that the court rejected the defense's attempts to use her past against her. And it seems like this case really comes down to the interpretation and the application of this rape shield rule. Can you maybe break that down for us a little bit more? What exactly is the rape shield rule and how does it work?
Yeah, absolutely. So Indiana's rape shield rule, like many other states, have similar rules. It's basically designed to prevent irrelevant and often very prejudicial information about a victim's sexual history from being used against them in court.
Like?
And, you know, the idea is that a victim's past sexual behavior, especially with people other than the defendant, it shouldn't be used to imply that they consented or to attack their character.
So are there ever exceptions to this rule? Like, when could a victim's past sexual history actually be admitted as evidence?
So there are a few very specific exceptions. You know, for instance, evidence of prior sexual conduct with the defendant himself. That might be admissible in some cases to prove consent, but even then, the court has to be really careful. They have to weigh how much that evidence actually helps prove a fact in the case against how likely it is to unfairly prejudice the jury against the victim.
That's a balancing act.
It's a tough balancing act. So in this case, because her past experiences were with other people, they were deemed irrelevant to the issue of consent with Williams and Edmondson.
Got it. So the court drew a very clear line in the sand here. Evidence of past sexual behavior with people who are not the defendant, that's generally not admissible, even in cases where consent is the big issue.
Right. And it's a very important statement about protecting victims from these kinds of attacks on their character and their past choices.
Absolutely. It's really a win for victims' rights. It affirms that their past shouldn't be used to define them or discredit them in court.
It is, and it goes beyond just protecting the victim. It underscores this idea that even in cases where consent is disputed, the focus should always be on the actions and the intentions of the accused, not on the victim's past.
Right. The legal system should be about holding the perpetrators accountable, not putting the victim on trial. But this case gets even more interesting because the court's reasoning goes even deeper than that. They made this really important distinction between the rape shield rule and another rule. Rule 404B, that deals with prior bad acts. It sounds kind of technical.
It is.
But it's really key to understanding why this decision is so significant.
It is. It is, yeah. So think of it this way. Rule 404B is like a tool that lets you bring in evidence of someone's past bad acts, but only in very specific circumstances.
Okay.
Like if you're trying to prove a motive or their intent. So, for example, if someone's charged with, like, embezzling money from a company.
Right.
Evidence that they've embezzled money before, that might be allowed in to show that, hey, they had the intent to do it again.
Okay, so it's like saying if they've done it before, they're more likely to have done it this time. But how is that different from the rape shield rule? I'm still a little confused.
Yeah, so the key difference here is that the rape shield rule, it specifically protects victims of sexual assault from having their past sexual behavior used against them. Even if it might seem relevant under this Rule 404B, the court in Williams v. State was super clear about that. You can't just use 404B as a loophole to get around the rape shield rule.
So even if the defense argued that, you know, the victim's past was relevant to proving motive or intent, the rape shield rule would still win out.
Exactly. The court saw right through what the defense was trying to do. They were trying to sneak in this prejudicial information about the victim. And the court emphasized that these are two totally different rules with different purposes. And when it comes to evidence about a victim's past sexual conduct, the rape shield rule, that's the one that matters most.
Okay, that makes sense. It seems like the court was very deliberate here, making sure that the rape shield rule was applied correctly and that its purpose, protecting victims, wasn't compromised.
Right.
But how did they actually justify their decision? What were some of their main arguments?
So one of the big arguments they made was based on this legal principle called probative value versus prejudicial effect.
Okay.
It's a mouthful, but it basically means that even if some evidence is relevant to the case, it can still be kept out if it's more likely to unfairly bias the jury than it is to actually prove a relevant fact.
That sounds a little abstract. Can you give us like a real world example?
Sure, yeah. Imagine a trial where someone's accused of stealing a car.
Right.
Right. And the prosecution wants to introduce evidence that the defendant has a huge collection of lockpicking tools. So that evidence, it might be kind of relevant, I guess, because it shows that, you know, he has the skills to break into a car. But it could also be really unfair to the defendant. The jury might just see those tools and think, well, he's got lockpicking tools, he must be guilty, even if there's no other evidence actually tying him to that specific car theft.
So even though the evidence might be technically relevant, it's excluded because it could sway the jury's opinion for the wrong reasons.
Exactly. And that's exactly what the court was worried about in Williams v. State. The defense was saying that the victim's past was relevant, you know, that it showed she was more likely to have consented. But the court saw this as, like, the exact thing the rape shield rule is meant to prevent: using a victim's past to make broad judgments about their character and their actions.
Right. So basically, they were worried about the defense trying to paint the victim as promiscuous and therefore more likely to consent, regardless of what actually happened that night.
Exactly. And they understood that letting that kind of evidence in, it would basically put the victim on trial. She'd have to defend her past instead of the focus being on what the accused actually did.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the court was very aware of how this evidence could unfairly prejudice the jury against the victim.
Absolutely. And Justice Bohm, he had a really great quote in the ruling. He wrote, "Rule 412 was enacted to prevent generalized inquiry into the victim's sexual conduct to avoid public denigration." So the court was really trying to protect her from that.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a reminder that the legal system needs to protect victims from being re-victimized by the very process that's supposed to be getting them justice.
Right. And it highlights this really tricky balancing act that courts have to do, balancing the defendant's right to a fair trial, but also the need to protect the victim from these unfair attacks and irrelevant information.
Absolutely. So speaking of protecting the victim, how did the court deal with that whole drug use argument and the possibility that it affected her memory? Did they just dismiss that completely?
Not entirely. They made an important observation that during the trial, her credibility had already been challenged when the defense was cross-examining her.
Right, right.
So they had a chance to question her story, point out any inconsistencies, you know, and really get into whether there were any memory gaps.
So the court basically thought that bringing up the past drug use again would just be beating a dead horse. They already had their chance.
Yeah, exactly. They were essentially saying, look, the defense already had the opportunity to question her testimony and bring up any concerns about her memory. Bringing up the drug use now wouldn't really add anything useful to the case.
It seems like the court was being very practical, you know, not wanting to get bogged down in these irrelevant details that could distract from the real issues.
Right. They wanted to make sure that both sides had a fair chance to present their case while also, you know, upholding these core principles of justice and fairness.
Okay, wow. This case is a real legal maze, and I feel like we've only scratched the surface here.
It is a complex case. We've talked about the facts, the rape shield rule, and even those really nuanced evidentiary rules like Rule 404B.
Yeah.
But there's another really critical aspect of this case that we need to unpack.
Okay.
And that's the idea of accomplice liability.
Accomplice liability. What's that all about, and how does it relate to this case?
So accomplice liability is a big deal in criminal law. It means that even if you didn't physically commit the crime, you can still be held responsible if you helped or encouraged or even just stood by and watched while the crime was happening. It's this recognition that criminal activity usually involves more than one person, and everyone who's involved should be held accountable.
So in this case, even though it was mostly Edmondson who was allegedly physically assaulting her, Williams could still be liable because, well, they were in it together.
Exactly. The court made it very clear that Williams was just as responsible for the attempted sexual assault as Edmondson was because they were acting together the whole time, driving her to that secluded place, threatening her, and trying to force her into these sexual acts.
So even though Williams wasn't the one actually physically assaulting her at the moment she grabbed the gun and shot Edmondson, he was still just as guilty because of everything he did leading up to that point.
Precisely. The court was not going to let him off the hook just because he could say, well, I wasn't the one who touched her. They saw his participation in the whole plan and in carrying out the crime as making him just as guilty.
Wow. This whole concept of accomplice liability, it seems incredibly important, especially in these types of cases where you have multiple people involved.
Oh, absolutely. It's an absolutely essential tool for prosecutors to make sure that justice is served. You know, it stops people from trying to escape responsibility by hiding behind these little technicalities or claiming that they were just a bystander.
It's like the law is saying, we see you. We know you were involved and you're going to be held accountable.
Exactly. It's about shared responsibility and making sure that all the people who contributed to the crime, they face the consequences.
This deep dive has been so insightful. I feel like I'm really starting to grasp the nuances of this area of law.
Me too.
We've uncovered so much. The facts of the case, how the rape shield rule works, even those really nitty-gritty details of evidence rules.
We did.
And of course, the whole concept of accomplice liability.
It's a lot.
But it's all connected. And it's so crucial to understanding how sexual assault cases work and how justice is pursued in these situations.
I think you're right. It is a lot.
It really is. Okay, so we've spent the last two parts of this deep dive, you know, really trying to unravel this legal knot that is Williams v. State. We've examined the facts, we've gone over the arguments and looked closely at the court's reasoning.
Right.
But now I kind of want to shift gears a little bit. And think about, you know, the bigger picture. What are the implications of this case? What kind of ripple effect did this ruling have on, you know, the legal system as a whole and on victims' rights?
That's a really great question. I mean, this isn't just about this one victim and these two guys. This is about shaping how the whole system deals with sexual assault cases. I think Williams v. State, it really had a huge impact on how we view victim protection and that balance between, you know, making sure there's a fair trial, but also protecting victims from these harmful biases.
Yeah, it feels like we're zooming out now, going from this one very specific courtroom battle to this larger fight against societal biases and this whole idea of using a victim's past against them.
I think that's a great way to put it. And I think what this case says to everyone in the legal world is that if you try to use a victim's past sexual history to discredit them or imply consent or even just make the jury feel sorry for the accused, that's not going to fly. The court in Williams v. State, they drew a line, and that line has had a lasting impact.
Yeah, so it's not just about protecting this one particular victim. It's about protecting future victims, setting a precedent that will hopefully make a difference in countless other cases.
Exactly. And I think it sends a very strong message to judges, to lawyers, even to potential offenders out there that this rape shield rule, it's not just some random technicality.
Right.
It's there for a reason, and the courts are going to enforce it.
And hopefully that, in turn, you know, creates an environment where more victims will feel comfortable coming forward, knowing that their past isn't going to be thrown back at them, that the legal system is taking their side.
Yeah, and that's so important because sexual assault is just so underreported. One of the main reasons people don't come forward is because they're afraid of not being believed or having their personal history scrutinized.
Well,
so cases like Williams v. State, they really do chip away at that fear. They show that the focus should be on what the accused did, not on digging into the victim's past.
It's about changing the narrative. It's about holding people accountable for their actions, not blaming the victim. But there's something that I've been thinking about this whole time. And I'm wondering, how do you strike that balance between protecting victims, but also ensuring that the accused gets a fair trial? I mean, could excluding certain evidence make it harder to get a conviction, even if the person is guilty?
That's the big question, isn't it? And it's one that legal scholars and people who actually work in the courts wrestle with all the time. It's a really tricky balance, and there's no easy answer. I think Williams v. State gives us a good example of how courts can try to navigate that tension. But it's an ongoing conversation. We have to keep asking those tough questions, keep trying to understand what true fairness means. And the legal system, it needs to keep evolving to make sure that it serves justice in all its complexities.
I think that's such a crucial point. The law isn't static. It's constantly changing. And each case, each ruling, even each argument contributes to that evolution. Williams v. State, it was a big step forward, but it's not the end of the road.
Absolutely. The fight for justice, it's a marathon, not a sprint. We have to keep pushing for a legal system that's fair and that's equitable and that actually protects the most vulnerable among us.
I couldn't agree more. Wow, what an eye-opening conversation this has been.
I agree.
You know, we started by looking at one single case, but this has really opened up this huge conversation about victims' rights and the legal system and the ongoing struggle for justice. We've covered a ton of ground today, but if there's one thing I hope our listeners take away from this deep dive, it's this. Knowledge is power. The more we understand about the law and how it affects us all, the better equipped we are to advocate for change and create a world that's more just. So keep learning, keep questioning, and keep fighting for what's right. That's the real legacy of Williams v. State, in my opinion.